And so I would like to start the discussion by asking each of you if you could just give us in 30 seconds and to put your research in a broader context and to tell us what you think the most interesting directions for research are in your field in the near future. And I don't know, Vero, you want to start?
Okay. You mean now concerning what I presented today? So I would really, as I said, what I presented today is kind of a preliminary thing. So we wrote it up already, mostly for Marius and me to finish our PhDs. So there are still a lot of open issues with what we started there. So one would be the constraint equations, to consider them in detail. And another thing, we wanted to show that the Lugano process in particular, but preferably maybe processes that could violate causal inequalities in general, are incompatible with Paige Wouters' state, which would be an argument against their physicality somehow. So that would be cool if we could show that. As I said, we didn't manage because we don't know what are all possible causal reference frame decompositions for such processes. So yeah, I think that would be interesting. But for me, I'm not sure this is of particularly broad interest.
Thank you. And Czeslaw?
Okay, so yeah, referring to what Veronica said, it would be even more interesting if you can show that it can be violated causal inequalities. That would be revolutionary. But with the danger of repeating myself what I said like 2 weeks ago, I think, personally, I think this program in different facets of quantum reference frames could be useful to address maybe questions that are concerned, that people in quantum gravity is concerned with their own language. And there is a gap. There is a gap between something what right now we feel quantum reference frames can provide and something else that is a deep quantum gravity regime. And the gap is the following. I didn't have time to talk about too much, but what we can do now is try to understand conceptually the situation in which we have superposition of classical configurations. So so if I may make this analog, is that in quantum mechanics, you have a classical-like states, which are coherent states. And then you talk about Schrödinger-Cat states as a superposition of coherent states. And then you can treat this almost as a superposition of classical solutions, because the distance between the classical these coherent states is much larger than uncertainty of each of coherent state. And so now we are doing something like that. We combine, so to say, the solution of GR and make quantum superposition of that, taking for granted the superposition principle can be extended, but this is a very conservative approach. But we don't talk anything about fluctuations or anything about how accurate is the single solution in GR, which is related to all fluctuations at the Planck scale. And so there is a gap, and I don't know how to, I think that in order quantum reference frames to have any use of, we need some, I have a feeling, a new element, which will not be a superposition of classical-like situations. And I would really like to know what this element is.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Rob, do you want to tell us? I don't know if you heard the question, the question is if you could put your research in a broader context and tell us what you think is the most interesting research direction in your field in 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
Maybe I'll just say that if one does buy into the idea that, you know, causal structure and causal relations are more fundamental than spatial-temporal relations, and so if we want to understand what a quantum notion of time is, we also need to understand what a quantum notion of causal relations are. Then it seems to me really critical, sort of getting starting on that project, to really figure out what in the quantum formalism is describing causal relations. I don't think that's obvious. One can't just start and say, okay, I know what causal relations are in quantum theory. Because this project of unscrambling what in the formalism is about causation and what's about inference is very subtle. Even in classical statistics, people have struggled mightily to disentangle these two notions, which is why the whole field of causal inference, sort of only 20 years old or so, is been trying to disentangle these. So the problem is compounded in the quantum case, where there's even less clarity on, you know, how to interpret the formalism. But I guess my comment would just be that, I think we really do need to sort out that problem if we want to be on sure ground when we're trying to quantize time.
Thank you very much. So I will now open the floor to discussion, but before, first I would like to ask everybody if you could keep the questions and or comments and answers short so that everybody gets a chance to speak. And before I open the floor to everybody, I would first like to give the possibility to the people who didn't manage to ask their question before during the talks, who are Patrick, Renato, Namrata, and Augustin, to ask their questions now. So I see that Patrick has his hand raised, so.
Yeah, cool. So first of all, I really enjoyed all of your talks. I thought they were really quite fascinating. But the question from before was from Rob's talk. And it's somewhat related, I think, to Marius's question, which was about the relation between the distinction that you make at the beginning between the subjective, I guess, the subjective fragment of quantum theory and the more objective fragment. And I take the distinction to be like, on the one hand, we've got this horizontal axis for these circuits describing our inference-making processes, which are taken to be kind of intrinsic to the agent or intrinsic to the theory user. And then we've got these vertical lines to be sort of extrinsic, and they're the things that the theory user are describing. Now, of course, if you take an intersubjective stance towards the ontology of quantum mechanics, there might still be some subjectivity at both levels, but we've got this separation. My question is about whether or not there's instances in which, like, maybe there's some nice kind of functor on this category of operational, just on this category, to say basically there are instances in which you can translate causal structure into inferential structure and vice versa. And what I have in mind here is something like, if you have, like, let's say you set up a computer to carry out Bayesian inference making tasks on some sort of, I don't know, quantum computing experiment that you're doing or something like this, then you have a physical process that's implementing this inferential process. And so you actually have kind of a causal simulation of the inferential process directly at the level of the classical circuits governing the computer that's carrying out these inferential processes. So maybe you could speak to something like that. Maybe there's a way to sort of rotate the diagram 90 degrees somehow.
Thanks for the question. I think just as we need, if we want to do classical Bayesian inference, we need to program that, and in some cases it's very difficult because, if I really wanted to represent the probability distribution and it becomes exponentially large, if I have n bits, my distribution would require 2 to the n parameters. So, we need all kinds of heuristics and shortcuts to do those sorts of computations. And I think the same thing will be true for an intrinsically quantum theory of inference. Presumably there would be advantages to doing that on a quantum computer, but even so, I expect that, you're going to need lots of good ideas for how to encode that and some heuristics for how to do it well. And it just in terms, I think, I can't remember exactly what you said in the first half of your question, but there's another sense in which the two things are kind of locked together, which is that, you know, the structure of your inferences kind of tracks the causal structure, right? Like if I have a common cause on two variables, the only reason learning about this one teaches me about that one is because it teaches me about the common cause, which teaches me about that one. And so in like classical statistics, if I already know everything there is to know about the common cause, then learning this effect teaches me nothing about the other effect. I get this conditional independence. And so, you know, the part of the framework we set up is to be able to have a language for describing all those sorts of effects, like in what ways your inference is kind of tethered to the causal structure.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
And Renato?
So I would also first like to thank everyone for the very nice talks. I really enjoyed them. I had a question for Rob, which I couldn't ask before. So this framework, I mean, first I must say I'm very kind of keen to learn this framework better because it seems it gives a very natural way of looking at quantum theory while being kind of time agnostic. So it looks like the preparation and measurement are treated on equal footing. And so all the measurement problems we have, or the problems we have understanding measurements, would also be reflected by problems of preparation, for example. Now, I have a question which somehow relates to the fact that I'm studying Wigner's frame type experiments. And maybe it's a bit related to what Patrick just asked, because if you look at an agent who is doing or applying inference rules, so it's applying logic in that sense, going from left to right. If I look at this process of making inferences from the outside, from another agent, then it looks just like kind of a physical process that the outside agent would rather describe as a kind of causal process, in the sense that he doesn't have his own description. So in some sense, going from this inside view to the outside, maybe the words of the question before, rotates the whole thing from inference to causal relations. Now, my question is maybe whether this even makes sense, this view that I just described, to say that essentially the statement is an inference process that we are doing as users of quantum theory is viewed from the outside, kind of maybe rather a kind of causal process. And if yes, whether the framework would maybe potentially allow to or would be compatible with this view. Maybe one thing I should add is that when you describe the Bell experiment, for example, then you have, for example, the choices of measurements which are treated as information we have, like for making inferences. But if I again look at this from the outside, I could say that there's a memory that stores the choice I've made. This is again just a physical system, and this system kind of gives this information further in time to another system. So I would kind of describe that again as a causal thing where initially there was a choice that was then in the memory stored in this later way. So this is maybe related to that view that Bell experiment that's viewed from the outside is a big quantum process where I wouldn't distinguish the memory that stores the initial choice from the actual particle on which I make the experiments. Not sure this makes sense, but that's...
Yeah. So let me just say a couple of things that might be helpful. That typically I would say, you know, a calculation about inference needn't proceed in a kind of linear way across the horizontal wire. So for example, if what I'm interested in is retrodiction, for example, maybe I have some information about what happened at the end of the experiment, and I want to propagate that information to figure out how I should update my knowledge about variables at the beginning of the experiment. So then I would be doing a calculation that would sort of start by specifying facts about what I know, propagating them, you know, backwards through the whatever connections, functions relate them. And I can imagine things being quite complicated. Maybe I know some things about the past, some things about the future, and I'm trying to make inferences about things that are at different places in this causal structure. So it needn't even be linear in one direction at all. And so the computation that one would do to make that inference wouldn't have to kind of respect the circuit diagram structure at all, except insofar as I would probably sort of bend down all the wires that are correspond to my givens and bend up all the wires that correspond to the things I'm trying to make inferences about. And I get some new circuit, and then the causal structure of the computation would somehow be related to that circuit. Now, the way the simulation works, it doesn't have to be sort of a, it needn't be simple. So in the inferential theory, there's sort of something like a copying operation, which you can think of as a linear map, takes a Hilbert space, maps it to two copies of that Hilbert space, and the reduction in each space is the original state. Now, that's not a physical map. There's a no broadcasting theorem, but I can define a linear operator that does that for me. And so this is the kind of thing that you'd have to simulate. And so you certainly wouldn't do it there's just no broadcasting operation you could appeal to. So you'd really have to be sort of, you know, simulating the mathematics of that calculation. We haven't thought much about, you know, what those simulations would look like. I think it's an interesting question, but it's definitely not as simple as, you know, just take that structure on the inferential side and, you know, call it causal or something like that. It's much more complicated than that.
Thanks.
Thanks. And then Namrata, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yeah, no, you are Namrata. Thank you. Both all of the talks today were amazing. So I have a question. Actually, I don't know. It could be both for Veronica and Rob. So to begin with, Veronica, you mentioned the thought process, the thought experiment of Alice and Bob. And then having different times to begin with. And then you introduced quantum clocks. And what I mean is, like, when you were talking about synchronization and then desynchronization, how do you think that would relate to natural synchronicity that we see in our natural world rather than just a thought experiment? I mean, an example would be metronomes.
Right. Okay. Okay. So the resynchronization, desynchronization is really for the non-causal process, where you kind of want different orderings for the different values of the control. That you do not really with a clock, so it's not. If you do, like, you can do the quantum switch or something as in an optics experiment, but there you regulate this via the control determining the way the particle goes through your experiment. So it's not really with some internal clock or something. I don't know. I mean, this twin paradox circuit was supposed to mimic a twin paradox, but of course it is not like a relativistic time dilation. It's really just, it was more a very constructed example to show, like, as a matter of principle, that you can, with this framework, implement varying clock speeds. I don't know any other other than relativistic time dilation, I don't know what other mechanisms you could think of, and whether this is, I'm pretty sure it is not well represented by the way we do it. As I said, this framework is all more of a toy model that enables us to use this circuit and quantum information language that is the usual one for the whole process matrix framework. And look at this from a Page-Wouters type of approach.
Right. I think one of the reasons I asked that was because it is not well known how such synchronizations occur in nature. So, like, I thought, like, using a toy model would give us more of an idea of what goes on, but, like, there's also the local versus global synchronization that can occur. And that's probably where, like, Rob would probably say something, where if we're talking about local realism versus global realism in terms of synchronization, it could be entangled particles, but I'm not sure. So I'm just, like, wondering if you have any more thoughts about that.
Rob, no, right? Okay.
Veronica, do you want to?
Well, So I don't really have any deep thoughts on that. And as I said, it's like this model that we use in this framework is, I mean, these are not clocks, like, or good clocks in a sense. They're just some constructed timekeeping system. So I think whatever I can think of in a response to your question will not be well represented in the framework that I presented in my talk.
Right.
And if I could just add something from the perspective of our framework. So maybe one of the points that did not come across well in my talk was that in this sort of approach, quantum states, pure quantum states, are analogous to probability distributions, right? They're on the inferential side, they're a description of knowledge. And therefore, to my mind, one of the advantages of this sort of approach is that when you're talking about an entangled state of two systems that are far apart, that's interpreted as just, you know, analogous to a correlated probability distribution. There's no holistic properties between those two systems. All the realities are local realities. And what happens when, you know, the wave function of the system of some distant system can be updated by virtue of measurements here is just essentially like Bayesian updating. I learned something about this system and it causes me to update my description of the distant system without changing the reality of that system. So there's no sense in which entanglement is modeled and is going to be modeled in this frame in terms of some sort of holistic type of properties.
So that would still count as, like, if you were to name it, it would still work as local realism, since, I mean, I'm just trying to understand, like, I'm very interested in, like, when you talked about, introducing realism in quantum mechanics. And so I think I'm looking at this from that point of view. So we still have some questions that aren't answered, but, like, this would be the path to go to, explain said entanglement that you mentioned.
Yeah, it's definitely just a research program at this stage. I mean, there's lots one could say about, you know, the what it suggests is the right interpretation. But, I mean, when you use the phrase local realism, I'm hearing kind of I'm imagining you mean it in the sense of how people talk about Bell's theorem. So, you know, if I look at the usual derivations of Bell inequalities, people talk about, you know, the locality assumption, which is Bell's notion of local causality. You might say that realism is sort of this commitment to there being a hidden variable explanation. And so from our perspective, those assumptions are all articulated within a framework of classical realist theory. So what we characterize as, you know, classical realist causal inferential theory. And so the notion of locality articulated by Bell sits in that framework. And what we want to argue is that you can have a more general notion of locality if you have a non-classical notion of realism, you can still talk about locality. You can ask questions like, hey, in my framework, is it the case that I'm explaining these correlations by a common cause, you know, rather than by requiring that things over here in this region influence things over here. And so we have a kind of more general notion of locality, which is not wedded to Bell's mathematical characterization of local causality. It's more general than that. But I still think it captures the essence of locality, that, you know, it should be a common cause explanation. And so what we're saying is that, yes, we can have a kind of locality in realism, but only in this more general framework. I mean, that's the project. It's not complete.
Okay. Thanks. So, okay, we can move on with the questions, Philip.
Oh, I think I forgot to unraise my hand, sorry.
Okay, so we have another question from Ben Liang.
Okay, I still I want to share some ideas, maybe with you guys. I still want to continue maybe from the last comment made about the pendulum clock, because I'm still wondering. I mean, if we have two pendulum clocks, now one is on a planet with a strong gravity, and the other one is on a planet with a weaker gravity. Then the pendulum clock on the strong gravity will swing faster, so a time measure become faster. So this is in the contradiction with the general relativity. So next, Next is the more bizarre part is if Alice and Bob are two twins. If we suppose Alice carries one pendulum clock and one atomic clock, and Bob carries another pendulum clock and another atomic clock. Then if Alice carrying her two clocks is on a planet with a stronger gravity, and while Bob carrying his two clocks is on a planet with a weaker gravity. So the question is, who would age faster, Alice or Bob? Because if we based on the time difference measured by the two pendulum clock, Alice is older since the time measured by her pendulum clock is faster than the time measured by Bob's pendulum clock. But based on the time difference measured by the two atomic clock, Bob is older since the time measured by his atomic clock is faster than Alice's atomic clock. So I think something is interesting here. Do you understand, yeah. Mike?
Thanks a lot. Let's see if somebody has a comment on this question. And otherwise, we can always post it on the Slack channel.
Because two clocks give offside readouts. So who would age faster?
So if nobody wants to comment, then I think we can move to the next question. Thank you for this comment.
Okay, thank you.
And Abe.
Okay, I have a quick question for Robert and then a longer question for Kassler. So quick question for Robert would be the following bit. I mean, in your general framework that you have, you're in the middle of constructing, right? I mean, about quantum causation, how much of the linear structure of quantum mechanics is necessary for you? I mean, as you were speaking, it seemed to me that it was not necessary at all. Of course, to talk about some specific questions like, you know, how would Bell's argument go, or how would Bohm's experiment of EPR go? There, of course, you have to use quantum mechanics because they were asked about the question itself uses linear quantum mechanics. But it seemed to me that your whole framework can be posed with, you know, very much more general framework than that of linear quantum mechanics. I mean, you probably need to specify, you know, some space of states and some probabilities, way of making probabilities and so on. So I was just wondering if you thought about this, or whether I'm just missing that, you know, that there's some reason for which linearity is absolutely essential for your framework.
Is linearity essential? I agree that the framework is certainly, you know, broader than, you know, it wasn't designed to only describe quantum theory. So for example, if we're talking about a classical theory, which involves some uncertainty, like take classical statistical mechanics, you know, where you
on a manifold, for example.
Or sorry, say it again.
Say, for example, a classical system described by a symplectic manifold. It's nothing.
Right. Yes. One of the ways you could certainly generalize relative to what I presented today was, you know, rather than have just any old functions as your causal mechanisms, you could demand that they're symplectomorphisms. For instance, you could demand that your systems aren't just sets, but they are phase spaces. You know, you could apply a lot more structure. It would still be a classical theory because of the kind of the nature of those objects. But yeah, you could add that in. And, you know, in those contexts, I think it would still be helpful to kind of disentangle for those theories what is about what you know and what's about, you know, what's there. Like, you know, is entropy a feature of the reality, or is it a feature of what we know? Those sorts of questions arise in non-quantum contexts. And then on the other side, there's like alternatives to quantum theory, like quantum theory over the quaternionic field or the real field. And there's sort of more radical possibilities that a lot of people in the foundations community in recent years have looked at, where you, for example, violate Bell inequalities more than quantum theory does. And you could imagine, you know, certainly trying to capture those sorts of theories in this kind of framework as well, and disentangling causation and inference. So in that sense, yeah, it's a more general framework. But I mean, we're really kind of most interested in saying, can we understand, can we reinterpret the formalism of quantum mechanics, sort of starting more deeply with a sort of notion of what a quantum realist causal inferential theory is, and maybe derive the aspects of the mathematical formalism of quantum theory that we're familiar with as kind of representing this interplay between causation and inference. You know, that's the project. And the linearity in this approach is going to come in, if you think about linearity of the maps on mixed states, on density operators, the linearity of that evolution comes in just from the fact of that if it's going to be convex linear. So if I'm going to say I don't know whether it's state one or state two, what's my knowledge about the final state? Well, it's just going to be the same uncertainty about the evolute of row one and the evolute of row two. That that's just a feature of my uncertainty. So that notion of linearity is I think essential, and the alternatives to quantum theory that involve nonlinearity from the perspective of this framework do not make sense. Like that's what, like one of the advantages, you say, what kinds of modifications of quantum theory make sense from this perspective, and some won't. Some would say, oh, that modification corresponds to imagining that what you think is going on could influence what's happening in the real world, and that's not reasonable, so we reject it.
Okay, but even when the example you're giving, because you already assumed that it was supposed to be a convex linear map, et cetera. But I could just imagine that all these states are just on some manifold, and therefore the mappings are diffeomorphisms. And then I just ask, I can just use some special types of diffeomorphism, which preserve something, could be volume, could be something else. So I didn't completely understand why, even in that example, linearity played such an essential role, unless you put it in the question itself.
Well, it's because the if you're thinking maybe from a physics perspective, kinematics and dynamics, you might say, well, there's really no constraints on the space of possible states. There's really no constraints on the dynamics. I can make them whatever I like. Sure, but if you're talking about a theory of inference, I think there really are genuine constraints after which you would say it's not a theory of inference anymore. So, for example, if systems A and B teach me something about system C, and then I decide to ignore A, I'm not going to have more information about C by doing that. So that's just an example of an axiom that I think any theory of inference should satisfy. And so similarly, it seems to me that convex linearity is just integral to what we mean by inference. If I tell you, look, there's classically, there's a variable here and I don't know whether it has value 0, 1, I assign probability P to it being 0. And now I'm going to flip it. I'm going to apply a function which flips the bit. What probability should I assign to it taking the value 1? Answer P. And if somebody says, no, it's a different value, I think I'm right to say, okay, that's not what we mean by inference. And so that's the sense in which that linearity, I think, is just a constraint on any theory of inference.
Yeah, I misunderstood what you said. Thank you. Okay. Maybe I've taken too much time, but I had a question for Kassel, but maybe other people have questions.
Thank you. So I have the order I have is Vilasini, Marius, and Thomas.
Hello. Hi. Thanks to all of you for the extremely interesting talks. I have two questions, but I'll try to make both of them really quick. The first one for Rob and the other for Czeslaw and Veronica. So maybe I start with the one for Czeslaw and Veronica. And this is related to what Veronica mentioned in her talk, that about this open question of whether this Lugano process can be seen as a non-causal Page-Wouter circuit. And the intuition I get from the Lugano process is that it looks a lot like some kind of a closed time-like curve that nevertheless is quite benign and gives you valid probabilities. So is it known whether the Page-Wouter's formalism explicitly forbids closed time-like curves, or whether there's a way to describe these? Maybe this could give some intuition as to whether or not the Lugano process is possible.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So I think there is a paper by Emin and others that show that you can realize this Lugano process as a post-selected closed time-like curve. But I actually don't know whether and which type of closed time-like curves you might be able to implement in a Pejhruta state, but yes, this is definitely also among the questions I'm interested in. So, but I don't know yet, simply, so I cannot give you any good insight there. But yeah, that would be a direction to go, especially if we try to think of something rather different from what we tried so far in implementing this process.
Okay, thanks very much. Yeah, and maybe a quick question for Rob. So when you talk about sort of having this quantum realist sort of causal model, is this really analogous to having like a, you know, like a quantum version of the Reichenbach principle, like they do in this quantum causal modeling kind of approach? And whether your open question that you kind of gave at the end is trying to come up with this causal inferential version of this sort of quantum causal modeling framework, is that a reasonable way to put it?
Yeah, that, certainly that's kind of one of the threads that led to this work, you know, thinking about trying to come up with a quantum generalization of the classical framework of causal models. But in retrospect, I would say that, you know, the efforts that we, you know, myself and collaborators and others have put towards that, there were a bunch of obstacles. And in retrospect, I think that the problem was that for a long time, you know, I at least was sort of committed to the idea that the right language in which to describe both a classical and a quantum causal model was in terms of conditional probabilities, completely positive maps, things like that. And as I tried to explain at the end of my talk, a conditional probability actually already involves a scrambling of causal and inferential concepts, right? This one conditional probability could represent situations with causal connection or causal disconnection. And so therefore, so does the complete positive trace preserving map. And it seems to me really critical to be able to sort of distinguish those two notions. You can't work at that level. You're already sort of working in terms of equivalence classes relative to this notion of inferential equivalence. You've already quotiented with respect to that. And in so doing, you've lost critical information about causal structure. So to some extent, what we're proposing is we need to continue that sort of program of trying to, you know, have, you know, something like Reichenbach's principle, be able to reason about counterfactuals, all the sort of stuff you can do with a causal model, but being more careful about how we separate causation and inference, even in the classical formalism, and then try to find the quantum analog of that new formalism.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. So I had Marius, Thomas, and then also Nathan wanted to ask a question. We are running over time, especially for Europeans. So I will ask you to keep them short so that everybody gets to answer their question, gets to have their question answered.
Okay, thank you very much. So I'm just trying to get a bit better your point of view, Robert. Very quick, is collapse a subjective effect, Bayesian update in the way you think about things?
Collapse of the wave function?
Yes.
If it's a collapse induced by measuring a distant system, it's purely Bayesian updating. If it's a collapse of the sort that's involved in like a projection postulate where you're measuring a system directly, then it's a combination of Bayesian updating, but also potentially some disturbance to the reality of the system. That's the view that emerges from previous work in this kind of framework. So it depends what kind of collapse you're talking about.
What's the difference between the two collapses? Sorry, I didn't understand.
So like in an EPR scenario, I can collapse the wave function of particle B by doing a measurement on A. So if you think about it, sometimes that's called remote collapse. I'm saying in this sort of framework, all remote collapses are just purely Bayesian updating. There's no change to the reality of B, only a change to my knowledge of reality of B based on what I've learned at A.
And what's the objective way to do a collapse?
Well, the other type of situation in which we talk about collapses in quantum theory is, imagine I do, say, a projection postulate type measurement on a system. There's just one system A, and I come up to it and I do a projection measurement postulate. I get a particular outcome. I collapse the quantum state, you know, according to the projection postulate. So in that circumstance, when you sort of analyze what that means in these sorts of approaches, it's partly Bayesian updating, but also partly a disturbance to the reality of the system. And there's no challenge to locality there because you're actually, your measurement device is interacting with the system. So disturbing the system is not a challenge to locality. So it, yeah, these remote and not remote collapses are represented differently.
Okay, let me leave you with one question and no follow-up, which is related to what you're saying. So can you give me an example of an objective or part of an objective reality that is part of objective reality that is observable? Or are you talking about the wave function as being the reality, the objective reality? That's what I'm trying to get my head around.
Ah, well, clearly you don't know me well, because if there's one thing that I would say is that the wave function is not part of reality. Okay. That's kind of the main starting point, that, you know, whereas most interpretations take pure quantum states, the alternative possible pure quantum states, the different possible descriptions of reality, in these sorts of approaches, they're just different descriptions of one's incomplete knowledge of reality. The sorts of things that will correspond to reality in these sorts of approaches will be things like when unitaries represent dynamics, the identities of those unitaries will be, different unitaries will be describing different realities, for example. So that would be an example.
But is objective reality measurable or observable or not?
In the sense that, you know, when we do measurements, we're getting information about that reality. Yes, it's just that the way that we imagine the reality and our information about it is not the conventional classical way. We can't say that the reality is, you know, some set of possibilities, and when I get information about it, that information is described by a probability distribution over those set of possibilities. That's what we're rejecting. But we're not rejecting the notion that there's a reality out there about which we have information. We're just sort of changing the framework in which you formalize how you have information about that reality.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry for taking up time. Thank you.
Okay, so I see that Tom doesn't have his hand raised anymore. So maybe we can move to Nathan's question.
Yes. So I would like to ask Rob, do you hear me?
Yeah.
I would like to ask Rob about two things, actually. One, what the arrow of time, what are your assumptions about the arrow of time? Second, do you assume something about the reality being stochastic versus reality being deterministic?
Let me start with the second question. To some extent, the philosophy of these sorts of approaches is a very conservative philosophy in a way that I think it's a good idea to try to hold on to all principles you can and isolate the strangeness of quantum theory into sort of as small a change as possible. So in my view, the notion of objective indeterminism is really one that is kind of pushed upon you if you take an ontic view of the wave function. And if you take the view that, you know, wave functions can describe lack of information, then there's no real reason to endorse stochasticity. So you can get away with imagining deterministic dynamics. And so that's what we do. So there's, in this sort of framework, if it succeeds, all causal dynamics will be deterministic. And all the indeterminism in quantum mechanics will be, you know, just based on ignorance, that you can't predict the outcome of the measurement because you have incomplete information about the systems that causally determine the outcome of that measurement. That's all that's going on. With regard to the arrow of time, I think implicit in the formalism we've got so far right now is that, you know, there is a causal ordering. So the causal theory involves a kind of commitment to a distinction between, you know, past and future, cause and effect. And I mean, there you could talk about the time symmetry of inferences, right? And there you get some, you can try to understand some of the time symmetry we see in quantum theory as merely being a time symmetry of inference, right? Like if I look at classical probability theory, the kinds of updates of my belief I can make backwards in time, you know, starting from some information about some systems and updating backwards, is exactly the same as the types of inferences I can make forward in time. There's the formalism of Bayesian probability theory doesn't see causal structure, doesn't see temporal order. So you have a clear time symmetry there. anyways, let me leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you very much. So we are running out of time, but I see that there is one more question by Shashank. Not sure if I'm pronouncing your name correctly. So if it's really quick, then please go ahead, but please keep it quick.
So my question is for Kaslav. In the, while he describes the framework of quantum reference frames, in normal reference frames, they have both position and momentum simultaneously, I mean, related by any coordinate transformation. So how is that possible in quantum reference frames? I mean, any notion of a reference frame should, I mean, classically, a frame has both a position and momentum at the same time. So maybe I miss this point somewhere. And the second question is also a small one again from for Kaslav. It's the same thing. It sort of looks like in one frame, there's entanglement. In another frame, there's no entanglement. So can't that be used to as in pick out special frames? Like you could do one measurement in a particular frame where there's entanglement, and in a frame that is translating with it, there's maybe no measurement. With that, you can detect which frame is actually moving and which frame isn't. And maybe the violation of Bell's inequalities isn't in one frame and is in another frame. So isn't that a problem?
There were several questions, but I'll try to keep short. So violation of Bell inequalities boils down to experimental data. These are like clicks in detectors. So surely as such, they are direct observed. Like these things do not depend on the reference frames, because these are just numbers in the notebook of our experimentalists. But what we have addressed in this paper is, what should I measure in the laboratory if I have like two particles that are moving with in a general superpositional momenta? Now, your question is also related to the fact that I said, well, entanglement is frame dependent, even in a non-relativistic case. But one should distinguish between entanglement and violation of Bell inequalities. Like the measurement data are frame independent. Entanglement is state property. Entanglement as such as a state is frame dependent. And this is also clear in the relativistic quantum physics because of the relativity of simultaneity. What is state in one reference frame doesn't need to be the same state in another reference frame. What is interesting that this appears also in non-relativistic quantum theory just by introducing quantum reference frame. By choosing different classical reference frame in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you will not have this thing. So I think that's the difference. But when you look why this happens, is because the different choices quantum reference frames actually induce different factorization of your Hilbert space, such that what is maybe in a product state in one factorization is entangled in another one. And I didn't quite get the first, but I thought like you are saying in the first question, how it's possible, but in a classical reference frame, you somehow move for the very definite momentum and definite position, but this is not impossible in quantum. And that's why you wonder how it's possible. What was it like, something like that?
Yeah.
Okay, that's why, the way how I see this is that if you think about translations or boosts, you always have this kind of you can think about, well, what happens at like if you define the translation as the difference between origins of at t equals zero, then you define something with respect to one specific quadrature, one specific observable. So translation is with respect to the relative position, the boost is with respect to relative velocity. You don't require both of them. So if you define like that, then you have kind of preferred observable with respect to which you define the quantum reference frame transformation. There is no ambiguity. And now a more subtle point is that in some cases, we can, we really have a superposition of classical situations, as I said, sometimes. And then each classical situation can be described as a coherent state with somewhat well-defined position momenta. And then you can jump in such a classical reference frame, but the extension is that we also consider superposition of classical reference frames. So sometimes it's really both X and P are well defined such that we can use the classical reference trans transformation, but on the top of that also superpositions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So we are already pretty late on our schedule. So I would like to thank our panelists again, and to all the speakers of the session, and also all of the people who participated and interacted during this discussion session.